Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about manatees with St. Petersburg Times environmental reporter Craig Pittman. He's the author of Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species. Manatees are gentle giants of tropical waters. These marine mammals are the iconic symbol of the state of Florida, and they appear on everything from license plates to beauty salon signs. Believe it or not, they've been mistaken for mermaids, and their closest relative on the evolutionary scale is the elephant. These homely creatures are about 10 feet long, grayish-brown with wrinkled skin, and flat, powerful tails that propel them through the water. Manatees are large, slow-moving animals that frequent coastal waters and rivers, and that's their fatal drawback in a maritime environment that is full of fast, hard boats. For over two decades, manatees have been a flashpoint of frequent environmental debates, and Craig Pittman has been there. His new book, Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species, provides the first in-depth history of the conflicts and struggle to protect this endangered species. Craig Pittman is a native Floridian. Born in Pensacola, he graduated from Troy State University in Alabama, where his muckraking work for the student paper prompted an agitated dean to label him the most destructive force on campus. Since then, he has covered a variety of newspaper beats and quite a few natural disasters, including hurricanes, wildfires, and the Florida legislature. Since 1998, he has reported on environmental issues for Florida's largest newspaper, the St. Petersburg Times. In 2004, he won the Waldo Prophet Award for Distinguished Environmental Journalism in Florida for revealing a secret plan by the state's business leaders to transfer water from sleepy North Florida to booming South Florida. The stories caused such an uproar that Governor Jeb Bush scuttled the plan. In 2006, he again won this award, although this time he shared the honor for the series Vanishing Wetlands, written with his colleague Matthew Waite. The series, which found that federal and state wetland protection programs were a sham that enabled development to wipe out swamps and marshes, also won a national award, the Kevin Carmody Award for Outstanding Investigative Reporting from the Society of Environmental Journalists. Pittman and Waite shared a second Prophet Award and a second Carmody Award in 2007 for a series called When Dry is Wet that exposed the flaws in the wetland mitigation banking industry. That led to their book, Paving Paradise, Florida's Vanishing Wetlands and the Failure of No Net Loss. His new book, Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species, published by the University Press of Florida, is Craig's second book. When I spoke to him recently, I asked Craig how he first got interested in manatees.
Well, I cover environmental issues for Florida's largest daily newspaper, the St. Petersburg Times, and in my 12 years on this beat, manatee protection issues are by far the most divisive issues I've covered. I mean, people really go nuts talking about the issue of manatees. Some people from the standpoint of, oh, I want to protect them, I want to do everything I can to save them, and other people from the standpoint of, hey, they're getting in the way of me enjoying my freedoms as an American, and therefore we should get rid of them or, you know, do something like that. And so, there has just been very little room for compromise. I mean, it's not quite this extreme, but it's almost like covering abortion issues. People just do not find any middle ground. So it seemed like a really, really good topic for exploring. I've written lots of stories on the subject. And, one thing that struck me is that, it's also a good example of how science embraces ambiguity, but law and politics do not. The law demands certainty. Politics often seems to be based more on anecdote than anything else. And so it seemed like a good topic for exploring those issues as well.
So let's talk about some of the science and biology of manatees. And
sure.
What is a manatee? Can you describe one?
One writer, I love this, described them as looking like a candy yam with flippers. They're very unusual looking creatures, and that's part of their appeal. Is they're just so weird looking. They're kind of homely. They were in the past in long ago history confused with mermaids, and in fact one of the first recorded sightings of mermaids, of manatees as mermaids, occurs in Christopher Columbus's logs, where he reports that mermaids are not nearly as attractive as he was led to believe.
really?
but they're marine mammals like dolphins. They have to surface to breathe about every 5 minutes. They have whiskers. They greet each other with something like a kiss. The females have nipples under their armpits. I mean, they're just very unusual animals. They're vegetarians. They eat lots of seagrass, and they are remarkably resilient and adaptable creatures. I call them the endangered species that's in your backyard, because they are just as likely to pop up by your backyard dock as they are hiding in the mangroves down in the Everglades. Part of their appeal is not just their interesting look, but also that they are there and you can see them and you can view them and say, wow, isn't that interesting? And some people are just absolutely dumbstruck by them. There are actually, I mentioned this in the book, that there are two recorded instances where elderly tourists who were visiting a place called Homosassa Springs saw manatees swimming up to the seawall they were standing on, and they were bending over going, aww, and their dentures fell into the water.
I know I've spent hours watching manatees when I visit my folks down in Florida, and they have this captivating appeal to them. How deep can they go, or are they really stay on the surface?
Well, they tend to stay close to shore. They tend to stay in nearshore waters, although they do travel. I mean, there's a small pod of manatees that migrates up to the Alabama area from time to time, and in fact swam through the area where the oil spill was, so there was a lot of concern about whether that would hurt them, but apparently they were smart enough to steer away from it. They are generally looking for seagrass beds, and so that tends to keep them more in the nearshore areas. And also, they are very sensitive to cold. So whenever there's cold weather, whenever the temperature dips below about 65 degrees, they tend to look for warm water refuges like springs or power plant outfalls to huddle up in. And so that brings them very close as well. And that's the time when you see them the most easily. You can go, a number of the power plants have set up actual manatee viewing areas for tourists to go watch them and view. I went one time and saw about 100 of them all gathered up in one power plant outfall.
And did they live by themselves or in groups usually?
They tend to be very solitary creatures, except when they're breeding. Boy, Katie barred the door. They have a very strong sex drive. And one of the scientists that I wrote about in my book, he made the mistake of the first time he got in the water with them, getting in the middle of a mating herd and nearly getting trampled, and got out of the water and said, I'm never going back in the water with manatees again, ever. But eventually he overcame that.
Now, I know in your book, Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species, you call manatees the hippies of the animal kingdom, staunch vegetarians,
yes.
Nonviolent, but with a powerful sex drive.
Yes.
So they're nonviolent as well.
Yeah, they like I said, they are vegetarians. They're not, you know, out catching fish like dolphins or eating other creatures. They are basically, they just want to be left alone, which frankly puts them in the same category as most of the people in Florida. they just want to pursue their own thing, man.
Now, have you swum with manatees?
I did. It was not a pretty sight. I'm not the strongest swimmer in the world, and I'm afraid I flailed around so much I scared away most of them. Only one of them hung around. I think he was nearsighted, perhaps. but it was in Crystal River. It's the one place in America where you can actually swim up to and touch a manatee, and it was an interesting experience. The thing stayed there and munched on seagrass, and I stroked its back, and the tour guide, you know, filmed the whole thing, and meanwhile, I'm sure, was checking his watch going, God, is this guy done yet?
Now, do they only eat seagrass, or do they eat other things as well?
Well, I mean, seagrass is their preferred food. The ones that are in zoo facilities for recuperation after being hit by boats, they'll eat lots of other stuff like lettuce, there's one in captivity in Bradenton named Snooty, the, probably the most famous manatee in Florida, that gets a special treat of carrots and things like that on his birthday. But primarily, yeah, they're just eating seagrass. And it's interesting, one, I didn't find out about this in time to put it in the book, but one biologist I talked to said, you know, there's a theory that that is their purpose, is that they are there, like cows are there to crop the grass in a pasture and maintain it, that the manatees help to maintain the seagrass beds, which are vital to lots of different important fish species.
That was actually going to be my next question, was where do they fit sort of in the ecosystem?
It's nobody has really researched that question. It's an interesting point, and it's kind of the thrust of what one of the first people to really focus a lot of attention on manatees was Jacques Cousteau. He came to Crystal River and did one of his undersea world specials there in 1972, and he said basically that he couldn't see that they had any purpose at all, but that didn't give them the right to exist, and that therefore people should respect them anyway. But nobody has really done a lot of research on where they fit into the ecosystem that they live in. But like I said, one scientist I talked to theorized that that's their purpose, that they help to maintain and perhaps even spread through their feeding and their excretions the seagrass beds that are so important to Florida's waterways.
And because of their connection with seagrass beds, is that why they're often called sea cows?
Yes, well, and also because of there's been a lot of talk about using them as food. I mean, the early settlers considered them quite the delicacy. One early writer said they tasted finer than the finest Tennessee beef. They were an utter taste sensation. One scientist I talked to, who had actually sampled one back in the 60s, said their meat had the flavor of beef, but the consistency of pork. And so that was the other reason why they were referred to as sea cows, is they, you know, like cows, they produce steak. Of course, nowadays that's illegal. But it was illegal in Florida since 1893, but that didn't stop a lot of people from eating them anyway.
So what are the threats to manatees?
Manatees were put on the endangered species list because of two primary reasons: the loss of habitat to development, and being hit by boats. And those are two threats that are still with us today. There's still a lot of waterfront development going on in Florida, not quite as much as there was before the economic meltdown, but it does still exist. And there are still boats out there hitting manatees and either injuring them or killing them.
Can you tell me about some of the earliest protagonists for manatees and some of the pivotal characters in the histories of both, you know, in the history of manatee science and manatee protection?
Yes. I mean, there are fascinating characters. The first guy I wrote about is a guy named Frederick Morse, who was one of the early settlers in Miami. And he was from Boston. He was known as a great boy for the Blarney, as somebody said. And so, of course, he went into real estate and politics. And he became South Florida's first big real estate mogul and got elected to the legislature and got a law passed in 1893 that said you are not allowed to kill a manatee unless you get a permit from your county commission, and it has to be for scientific purposes. It can't just be for food. There are no real records to indicate why he did that, but he was close friends with Kirk Monroe and Mary Barr Monroe, who were among the original founders of the Florida Audubon Society. And Kirk Monroe was at the time the most popular children's book author in the country, and had written a book that mentions manatees as being an imperiled species. So my theory that I put forward in the book is that Kirk and Mary Monroe talked him into passing this law, and perhaps even wrote it for him as a way to try and protect this species. Of course, as with most laws, there was very little enforcement, and that's sort of the story today, is a law that's rarely enforced is obeyed only when it's convenient. Probably the next two guys, and they're still the most important guys in the history of manatee science, are Joe Moore and Woody Hartman. Joe Moore was one of the first biologists hired by Everglades National Park, and his boss was really interested in manatees and said, you know, some people say they're disappearing, some people say they're not. Go out and find out the truth. And this is in 1949. So Joe Moore writes to people all over the state of Florida. He goes through all the park rangers' patrol logs. He goes around in a boat all over the place. And finally somebody tells him, well, if you want to see manatees, the best place to do it is to stand on this bridge in downtown Miami on a cold winter morning and just look down. And so he did. And sure enough, there was a pod of manatees in the water, and it happened to be they were in a power plant outfall. It was the first time anyone had discovered that that was an attraction for them. And so Joe Moore started studying these manatees, but he was having trouble telling one from the other because, you know, all manatees look alike to people, just as I'm sure all people look alike to manatees. Then he noticed that some of them had scars on their backs from being hit by boats, and he had this flash of inspiration that that would be the way to tell them apart, that they're like fingerprints that have been carved out with a buzzsaw. And he drew up a little template with the shape of a manatee and marked it according to where he saw scars, and that was the way he could tell one from the other and determine, okay, this one's a female, this one's having calves, that kind of thing. And they are still using that method today to tell manatees one from the other. They have what they call a scar catalog with thousands of manatee pictures in it. It's a computerized database, and it still follows Joe Moore's method.
Now, that's different than, like, whales telling the difference between individual whales with notches and marks on their tail, because it's scars from a boat from an accident.
Yeah, it's artificial scars. It's not natural. And, I mean, I guess it's somewhat like with right whales. I know they have a sort of a whale mug book for right whales, but there are only, 300 of those? So it's not quite as extensive. And then the next guy is Woody Hartman, Daniel Woody Hartman, who was a Ph.D. student from Cornell who came down to Crystal River to study manatees. He had this revolutionary idea that nobody thought of before, and this is in the late 60s, that to actually get in the water with the manatees and swim around with them and study them that way. And he discovered, number one, that they don't like scuba gear. It scares them off. So he used snorkels.
Really? Why does the scuba gear scare them off?
The bubbling. The bubbling. The bubbling from the scuba scares him off. So he would use a snorkel, and that way he could slip up beside him and study him very closely. He had a waterproof camera that he'd borrowed from a local dive shop, and would, you know, took lots of pictures of him and documented their lives over the course of some time. And his dissertation that he wrote eventually became a book that was and still is sort of the Bible for manatee biologists. A lot of the observations he made, a lot of the theories he put forward, they're still holding up today. It's quite an achievement. And he was an interesting guy because, of course, he was a long-haired Yankee college student coming down to very, very southern, buzz-cut, conservative small-town Florida to study this strange creature that most people still regarded as a cross between a speed bump and Sunday dinner. he had a hard time fitting in, but then he made friends with a local teenager named Buddy Powell, who had a Boston Whaler, which was a much faster boat than what Woody Hartman had. And so Buddy Powell agreed to help him out. Well, so Buddy wound up taking a lot of the pictures and helping him with the studies and that kind of thing. And Buddy himself wound up going into manatee biology and is probably one of the premier manatee biologists in the world today, and has studied dugongs in Africa and Belize and so forth. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, how their paths crossed and how it altered Buddy's future that way.
Interesting.
I should mention, by the way, that some of the manatees that they studied up there back in the late 60s are still there today. One in particular named Sadie, who is in her 60s, has had calves, has lost part of her tail to boats. She's still there. She still abides and is still swimming around in the Crystal River waters today.
How long do manatees live?
They, believe it or not, their closest relative is the elephant. And so,
really?
Yes. On the evolutionary scale, yes. And so the theory is that they can live as long as elephants, which would be about 80. They have one in captivity who is in his 60s. They have Sadie out in Crystal River, who they believe is in her 60s. So those are kind of the oldest ones that we know of. Most of them don't live that long. In fact, quite a few of the females die very young after not getting a chance to reproduce more than once or twice because of either being hit by boats, or some of them are killed by cold, or another leading cause of death is red tide, the red tide organism that puts toxins into the air and into the water whenever there's a big bloom. Sometimes quite a few manatees die from that.
And what is the reproductive cycle? How good are they at reproducing?
They're very slow, which is one reason why they have such a strong sex drive. They really, really, really want to reproduce because they know it's going to take a while. And I mean, that's been kind of the limitation on them, is that they lose, you know, they lose an estimated 10% of the population every year, and so they don't really grow that fast or grow very much.
They lose 10% of the total population, not just the population of newborns?
No, the total population, the estimated population. I mean, nobody really knows for sure how many manatees there are. They do aerial surveys and try and count them from the air, but one biologist I talked to said that's like trying to count popcorn while it pops. it's really hard to spot them because they spend most of their lives underwater. So they do other things too. You know, they every manatee that dies, they bring in the carcass and examine it and try to determine the cause of death. I call it CSI CCAL. They have done all kinds of studies with radio tracking, satellite tagging, and so forth. But so far they have not come up with a better way to determine the population than those very, very flawed aerial surveys. But the most recent aerial survey they did, they found about 5,000 manatees in Florida waters, which is a higher count than they've ever made before. And they think that's a sign that the protective measures that have been put in place, controversial though they were, appear to be working.
Do manatees live anywhere else than Florida?
There are relatives of theirs that live in, say, Belize or in Africa, but they've done DNA testing. In fact, this just came out a couple of months ago, that the Florida manatees are genetically distinct from those other populations. The manatees in Florida tend to stay in Florida, although every now and then you hear of one that wanders away. The most famous one is Chessie, that I believe got as far north as Rhode Island before they said, no, the Interstate 75 is that way.
What happens when an animal gets new scars? Can they still be identified by the old scars? Or is that?
Well, I mean, they continue to spot them and to add to the identification. Case I talk about in the book is a manatee that had 49 separate and distinct sets of scars from 49 different boat collisions. And the reason they knew that it had, you know, 49 is that then it had a 50th one, and that one was fatal. And they brought it in and said, okay, we can match all these other scars, and look, this one's new. This is the fatal one here. But they keep close documentation on them as much as they can during, you know, in the winter when they show up at these distinct places like Blue Spring, Crystal River, the power plant outfalls. There are volunteers and park rangers and manatee biologists who go out and try and document them with photos and add to the scar catalog to say, okay, you know, this is the one we documented in 2000 and had this scar, and then 2005 it had this scar. Well, now it appears to have these two additional scars as well. They're interesting in that their bones are very brittle. They're like china plates, but their skin is like ripstop nylon, and it heals very rapidly. And so if they are cut, the cuts heal up, and they show the scars. You can still see the scars. But most of the fatal boat collisions occur because their bones have been shattered. And the bone fragments will pierce a lung or pierce the heart, something like that. And the other interesting thing is a majority of the fatal manatee boat collisions have occurred with, apparently, while the manatee was attempting to swim away, based on the orientation of the wounds. That's the theory. So they were trying to get out of the way, they just weren't fast enough.
So manatees, as we know, are very slow moving, is that right?
Well, they tend to be, but if they sense a threat, they can put on a burst of speed and hit, you know, I think about, I don't remember off the top of my head, but they can go pretty fast for a short distance, a sprint, if you will, if they sense a threat.
How do they move around? They have a strange tail in back there.
The fluke, propels them, you know, just the way of, I mean, that was kind of the resemblance to the mermaids right there. They had that sort of mermaid tail on them, and that's how they would move around, and they would come up and, you know, surface to breathe, and then you would see the little flip of the tail as they went back down, a little swirl of the water.
Now, after Frederick Morris, what happened with protection of manatees. So there was this law put in
in
place
1893.
In 1893.
Yes.
Where you
and
need
then,
a need a permit for scientific purposes, not for meat.
Yeah, that was largely ignored, of course. but the you know, then you have to kind of go all the way up to 1966, 1967, when the U.S. first prepared the original endangered species list, and initially manatees weren't going to be on the list, and there was this obscure federal official named Walter Gresh in Atlanta who said, you know, that's not right, and I'm going to see what I can do about it. And he wrote to Florida officials, and he wrote to his bosses at the Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, and he got manatees added onto the list. So they were on the original endangered species list that came out in 67. And then when the Endangered Species Act passed and when the Marine Mammal Protection Act passed in 73, 72 and 73, manatees were covered under those two laws, which are supposed to be very, very strong laws. But once again, you have problems of enforcement.
Tell me about the one time that they've put someone in jail for a manatee-related crime.
The one case that I talk about in the book where they actually put a guy in, the one time they put a guy in jail for killing a manatee. He would not have been put in jail except he had a family of kids waiting at home who were hungry. He was a boat captain in the town of Stewart, and he had a baby manatee that got caught in his fishing nets, in his boat's fishing nets. And it was killed, and so he.
So it was killed
took
almost
it, took it on board
and,
as and like cut a, it up for the meat, and was taking the meat home when he was pulled over by a couple of state wildlife officers who were checking for fishing violations. And this guy had some previous fishing violations, and they didn't find anything and let him go. And then they discovered the meat floating in the water behind the boat, so they pulled him over again. And under questioning, he finally admitted, "Yeah, that's mine, and yeah, I killed it." And he wound up serving 6 months in a federal jail for killing a manatee. He's the only person who has ever gone to jail for killing a manatee in all the years since the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973.
Now, most of the time, how are manatees killed? From boat accidents?
A lot of them from boat accidents, a lot from cold. Those are the kind of the two leading causes of death. And obviously we can't do anything about the cold, but, so they focus on the, you know, the man-made causes of death, the human caused mortality.
Is it possible to prosecute somebody who has hit a manatee by illegally, you know, speeding along or being in areas that are not allowed for boats?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and our state wildlife officers hand out tickets for people who are caught speeding in manatee zones. But they have, like I said, they've only prosecuted the one guy for actually killing one. Because often what happens is there's no eyewitness who sees the crime occur. They find the carcass maybe, you know, several miles from where the crime actually occurred. There's no crime scene to outline or to examine. So it's just really difficult. But even in case, there are some cases, and I documented at least one in my book, where they knew who did it. They knew who killed this particular manatee, but they took no action on it because it would have caused all kinds of problems. And then in this particular case, it was the U.S. Navy that had killed one that had a satellite tag on it. So they could tell satellite tag quit operating. They could tell exactly when it happened and where. The government chose to do nothing about prosecuting itself.
Maybe not surprising, but
maybe not.
So about how many have been hit by boats, and you know what happens and why does it happen?
Quite a few. I don't remember off the top of my head what the number is, but you know, they've been tracking it since 1974 when they started doing the manatee autopsies, or necropsies as they're called. And they, you know, they're hit. It's the blunt force trauma from the boat's skeg that tends to cause the most fatal injuries. Although we have this idea in our heads often that it's the propellers, because the propellers do cause very serious injuries. You know, they leave this kind of zipper type injury along the hide. But the actual blunt force trauma is what tends to be the cause of death in a lot of these cases. And as I said, often the manatees are trying to get out of the way, but the boat's moving too fast for them. And that's why one of the big pushes has been to try and make boats slow down, to create zones where boaters have to create a no wake or go idle speed. And those have been controversial because a lot of those places are places where the boaters are trying to get somewhere else. It's like telling drivers, hey, okay, I know you're on the interstate and you're going home for Christmas, but you have to slow down to 10 miles an hour. Well, people don't like that. They feel like that infringes on their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and so it's been very controversial. And the people who are opposed to a lot of the manatee protection measures often have some money involved as well. You have the boat manufacturing industry that has financed a lot of the opposition because they don't want people to stop buying boats, obviously. And then you have folks involved in waterfront development who've said, you know, hey, you know, why are you trying to protect manatees by protecting their habitat? Look, the population's growing. You know, why do they need special protection? Are they really endangered? And so there became this big fight here in Florida over whether they were even really endangered anymore.
Well, that's a question if you don't know how many there are.
Exactly. Well, but here's the thing is, and this is, I kind of explored this some in the book, that the people got the wrong idea about why they were on the endangered list. They're on the endangered list because of the threats that they face, not because of how many there are. And that was very explicitly stated when they were put on the list in 1966. The threats that they faced that got them put on the list are still the threats that they face today. Those have not gone away. So, you know, is it right to take them off the endangered list and say, well, we know they're still facing the same threats, but we don't think they're endangered anymore? That's a question a lot of people in both federal and state government have wrestled with, and they have had a hard time coming up with an answer.
You note in your book, Manatee Insanity, that in 2007, when economic conditions began to basically keep a lot of recreational boats on dry land, that the number of manatee deaths fell quite markedly. And can you talk a little bit about that, how there have been changes over time in what's been happening with the manatees and boats with this conflict?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, even when Jacques Cousteau shot his special in Crystal River in 1972, he showed scenes of boaters actually, you know, you can actually see a boat running over a manatee. And the cover of my book is a picture taken down in Miami, an aerial photo of a boat that has just run over a manatee. And you can see where they're intersecting. It's, you know, they're both sharing the same waterways. And they're, unlike roads, nobody's making any new waterways in Florida. So as you have more and more boats, and we've passed the 1 million mark as far as boat ownership, you're going to have a lot more conflicts with manatees who are trying to use those same waterways and get access to seagrass beds and so forth. So a lot of the efforts to protect manatees since the 70s have focused on trying to make boaters slow down, or in some extreme cases telling boaters you can't come in here at all. And those have been very controversial because, you know, boating is one of the primary methods of recreation in Florida, as well as a way for a lot of people to earn a living, you know, fishermen and fishing guides and so forth. And so those folks have seen these efforts at protecting manatees as a threat to their livelihood or to their lifestyle and have protested accordingly. The very first scene in my book, in fact, concerns a public hearing that they had in the town of Fort Myers in 2002. Where the Fish and Wildlife Service was proposing some rather stringent new rules on building docks for boats, because the federal government said, well, look, we issue permits for docks. You add more docks, you're adding more boats in the waterway mean more manatee deaths. Therefore, if we crack down on how easy it is to get a dock permit, that's a way to limit the number of boats. 3,000 people showed up at this convention center in Fort Myers to scream bloody murder at the Fish and Wildlife Service and say, don't do this. You're hurting us. One woman said, these creatures are infringing on my habitat. She was a real estate saleswoman, by the way.
And how?
So, I mean, that's kind of been the controversy is, you know, you have this, it's been kind of interesting. The people who are manatee advocates have this ideal of wilderness that manatees are a symbol of, that they like this idea of freedom and wilderness and this sort of almost antediluvian picture of Florida as it once was. And on the other hand, you have the boaters who have somewhat similar ideals, that they like the idea of freedom and wilderness and being able to have, you know, the unfettered right to go out and recreate the way they want. And even though they have a similar goal, the two sides are so far apart that they just don't even want to talk to each other in some cases.
Now, you mention in Manatee Insanity that Florida's war over the manatee is really, and you quote a New York Times article on one of the fiercest fights over an endangered species since loggers in the Pacific Northwest have strung mock spotted owls on the grills of their trucks. And how heated did these debates really get? I mean,
that opening scene
was really stunning because you don't expect that huge of a crowd and that amount of passion over.
Oh, it was incredible. And, you know, on the other side, you had manatee advocates. One woman was saying, okay, somebody beat me up, and then we can blame it on the boaters. and nobody, she said, and she was very disappointed. She said, and nobody would beat me up. Nobody would do it. So, I mean, people on both sides were just going way overboard on this stuff, pardon the pun. And it stirred tremendous passions in the same area where they had that big crowd at the convention center. They had people putting signs on their, you know, restaurants putting up signs saying, now selling manatee burgers. There was a popular sticker for the back windows of cars and trucks that showed the cartoon character Calvin urinating on a manatee. They had one boat captain actually got, there's a manatee, a Save the Manatee license plate to raise money for scientific research, and this one boat captain got one and had the words "eat 'em" on the license plate as his license plate numbers, until the local newspaper did a story about it, and then the state rescinded its license plate, which caused even more controversy. So, I mean, it's, you know, the passions run very, very high over in Brevard County, over in the same area where Cape Canaveral is. The voters groups there were so passionate that they actually, without a lawyer, took the state to court to try and battle some of the regulations. I think it was a week-long trial over it. There, in the Fort Myers area, the clerk of courts himself went out and got a speeding ticket in his boat just so he could go to court and challenge the legality of the manatee protection laws. And virtually the entire judiciary had to recuse themselves from the case because they were all the guy's fishing buddies. So I mean, it became this huge, ongoing, roiling, emotional, passionate battle over the future of Florida and whether we would continue to do things the way we have always done or whether we would make some change in order to share space with nature.
Where is that coming out?
For now, a couple of factors have led to a sort of a ceasefire. One is that the battle over whether they're endangered or not came to a sort of a draw. The now outgoing governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, stepped in and said, you know, I don't want them taking them off the endangered list. And so his wildlife commissioners deferred the decision on removing them from the state's endangered list sort of indefinitely. And so on the one hand, that has kind of ended, at least until we get a new governor, and we'll see what happens then. On the other hand, the economic meltdown that the entire country has gone through has hit Florida particularly hard. So there's not nearly the pace of waterfront development that there was, and the boat sales have slacked off considerably as well. So those two factors have kind of calmed things down for now, although, you know, let the economy turn around, let a new administration take office in Tallahassee, and we'll see what happens.
Regarding this fight, I was curious about some of the major and minor players in the dispute, in particularly related to the manatee speed zone. And you mentioned in your book, Manatee Insanity, that, for instance, O.J. Simpson was busted for violating that speed zone.
Spurring lots of bad puns in newspapers across the country.
People can Google that.
He was out recreating with his then girlfriend and was pulled over for going too fast. And, you know, I don't want to make tasteless jokes, but he proclaimed his innocence and said he would fight the charge and then failed to show up in court and wound up getting hit with a ticket anyway.
What was his fine? It was small.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very small, which, you know, that's been seen as part of the problem all along too. Is that a lot of times when there is a fine, it's not a large one, and so you know, it's not much of a deterrent when you think about it that way.
And how much is the fine? Like $65 or something?
It varies. You know, if it's a state citation, it's lower than the federal citation. Federal citation tends to be much larger. But the other thing about a lot of the federal citations is if you pay them, then there's no record of it afterwards. It's as if it didn't happen. So, you know, and the feds, there are very few wildlife officers out able to spend time in the water to enforce the rules. And so they tend to do like a strike force thing. They'll you know, pick like, say, Labor Day, which is a big boating holiday, or Memorial Day, and go to a place where they know there's lots of boating activity and pull over everybody they can see that's violating it, knowing that they're missing a lot of them, number one, or number two, that it's just a temporary thing, and then the next weekend everybody's going to be back speeding again. A lot of the state wildlife officers have been hampered by the fact that they don't just do boating violations. They are out there, you know, looking for poachers, looking for people violating fishing rules. A lot of them got pulled in to do homeland security stuff on the ports after 9/11. So they have a lot of other duties to do besides just enforcing the manatee zones. So that's been a problem for them as well. So even though there are a lot more of them, they have a lot more duties to pursue, and so they don't get the chance to go out and hand out tickets that much either. I actually went out riding with one of the cool things about my job is I get to get paid to go out in a boat every now and again. And I actually went out and spent a day patrolling with a couple of officers down in the Fort Myers area, and everybody they pulled over was incredibly hostile towards them. And the list of people they pulled over included a local sheriff's deputy who frequently helped them enforce the manatee zone laws. He was speeding in his own private boat while off duty and showing his family around. And he was not happy about getting pulled over. And they let him off with a warning. And if I hadn't been there, nobody would have ever known about it. But one of the wildlife officers told me, yeah, we actually pull over a lot of local deputies, but what are we going to do? We don't want to start a war with the local law enforcement. And so if that's the attitude among law enforcement, imagine what, you know, John Q. Public feels like.
You mentioned another instance where it involved Jeb Bush allowing filming of a chase scene.
Oh, yes, for the movie Bad Boys 2, yes, where the producers of the movie wanted to film a chase through Miami on boats, but it would be through an area where they would be violating all kinds of manatee speed zones, so they sought permission to get those rules lifted just for the time period they were doing the filming, and initially they got turned down, and so the production company hired a lobbyist who had lots of connections, and he got a meeting with the governor, and lo and behold, they got their permit to film, but with the proviso that there would be someone on the lookout for manatees who would stop the action if they spotted them. And I think they stopped it about 7 times during the filming of that scene. But they got their, 30 seconds of film for the movie and got it out in the theaters.
Which highlights the whole idea of if people at the highest levels in law enforcement and politics will throw away the laws for a better opportunity.
Well, it's interesting. In some ways, Jeb Bush is a crucial figure in the whole history of manatee protection because he said flat out, the manatee is my favorite mammal. And he took some actions towards trying to increase protection for them. But he actually convened the one and only big public meeting between people of all sides, people coming from all directions. He made them all sit down in one room for a day-long manatee roundtable, and they actually hashed out an idea that they all supported, that there would be an added charge onto fuel sold at boat docks to boats, and that surcharge would go towards putting more law enforcement officers on the water to enforce the existing manatee protection rules. Manatee advocates loved it. The boating people loved it. You know, the developers didn't have any objection to it. And they brought this idea to Governor Bush, and he said, no, that smells like a tax. I don't like taxes. And that was the end of it. And if that had gone through, it might have ended a lot of the subsequent turmoil that occurred because of lawsuits and other things that followed after that, because one of the arguments in the big thrust of the book is everything leading up to this big lawsuit that the Save the Manatee Club and some environmental groups filed against the state and federal government, and they are charged that the state and the feds were not following the rules under the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act and were not providing the level of protection that they were supposed to under the law. And obviously, if they had a lot more law enforcement people out there enforcing the rules, they might not have been able to argue that in court successfully.
So can you talk about this lawsuit a bit more?
Yeah, the suit was actually filed in 2000, and it's kind of ironic that the suit was based on things that had been done under the Democratic administration of Governor Lawton Childs, where they felt like the state government was not fulfilling its obligations to enforce the speed zones and so forth to protect manatees, to do things to protect manatee habitat. And they also filed a similar federal lawsuit against the federal government, charging primarily the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers of not protecting manatees and issuing dock permits. And the Fish and Wildlife Service was named as a defendant as well. But the primary thrust of that lawsuit was aimed at the Corps of Engineers. Both the state and the feds settled the lawsuit, and it was up to even though these things had occurred under Democratic administrations, the things that they were complaining about, it became up to Republican administrations, the administration of Jeb Bush and the administration of George W. Bush, to carry out the settlement that had been agreed to. And there was a lot of reluctance to fulfill the requirements of those settlements. Bush's administration did not like the idea that the federal government would be in charge of doing a lot of things, setting speed zones, setting new manatee sanctuaries and so forth, and pushed for the state to take the lead, which was contrary to what was in the settlement agreement. And on the other hand, you had the George W. Bush administration, which was not thrilled with the whole idea of endangered species protection anyway, and they were quite willing to let the state take the lead, to the point where Gail Norton, then the Secretary of the Interior, was actually told by a judge, you know, look, you're facing contempt of court charges if you don't do what you're supposed to do under your obligations under these settlement agreements. And so Norton actually sent one of her assistant secretaries down to try and calm everybody down and get her off the hook for contempt of court. I mean, it got to that stage where people were just so upset. And this assistant secretary of the Interior, his name was Craig Manson, he went down to the Fort Myers area to meet with some of the very angry people down there, and they got angry at him, even though he was on their side. So he met with the mayor, and the mayor brought along the police chief, I guess, as security to make sure that this federal bureaucrat didn't do anything wrong.
And were the terms of the settlement actually carried out? And what specifically were those terms?
Well, there were a lot of requirements for new sanctuaries, new areas with speed zones, to make boats slow down or prevent them from coming into certain areas. The federal settlement also called for doing a cumulative impact study on all of the permitting that was going on for new boat docks, new waterfront development, and so forth. The new speed zones and everything, those went in. But the cumulative impact study never got done, and that's where everybody kind of dropped the ball. And the attorney for the Save the Manatee Club said, you know, this was the first time we'd ever filed any sort of suit like this. Asking for the cumulative impact was kind of a daring move. Ideally, that would have been a great thing to have. The fact that they still have not produced it means, frankly, that they're still vulnerable if we ever wanted to go back to court on this thing.
Are there plans to go back to court?
At this point, I don't think so, because, I mean, frankly, pursuing something like this in court costs a lot of money, and I actually documented that in the book, where they probably would not have been able to pursue this if not for a major donation from one of the original programmers for Microsoft. Still had lots of money from stock from that, and kind of swooped in and saved them at the last minute when they were running low on dough. You know, I just don't see that happening right now. So I think the same thing that is keeping boats off the water right now and waterfront development from occurring is also probably preventing the environmental advocates from going back to court over all this stuff.
What will it really take to make Florida a safe haven for manatees?
Well, some people jokingly have told me global warming and sea level rise. when the sea level comes up, then it's going to wipe out all that waterfront development, and manatees will have their habitat back. Plus, they won't have to worry about all those cold snaps anymore either. It'll be much warmer for them. They can spread out. They can, you know, swim around up in Boston and have lots of warm water. I don't know. I think it's going to require a change in the way people think. That a lot of people come to Florida and they have a very selfish view of what they're here for. They're here for pleasure and the pursuit of pleasure, and that they don't want responsibility that comes along with that. And it's going to require some change in that thinking, that, to think, you know, I have a responsibility to, you know, protect the things that make this state attractive to me and attractive to other people. And it's been hard educating the people who come here to that fact. A lot of people regard Florida as, you know, one big ashtray. And they come here and they do what they have to do, and then they leave their litter all over the place and go back home. So will that change? I don't know.
What can people do if they're interested, especially if, you know, being from Vermont, vacationing in Florida, sounds like a familiar thing, get out of the cold.
Oh, yeah.
But what can they do if they're interested, and where can they go for good experiences? Or
Well, I, if you're here in the wintertime, I would strongly encourage you to go visit one of the power plants in the Tampa Bay area. The Tampa Electric Company plant in Apollo Beach has a very nice viewing area. I took my kids there one winter day just to get them off the Wii for a little while. One of my kids actually said, "Dad, this is cooler than video games." it's quite an impressive sight. A lot of the state parks feature manatee viewing areas. Blue Spring is one where manatees have been coming there since at least the 1700s. They were documented by William Bartram in his book about travels through Georgia and Florida, and they're still there at Blue Spring in Central Florida. And over on the state's Atlantic coast, you can see manatees at the power plants there as well. If you're in Miami, you go to Turkey Point, you can see not just manatees, but also, American crocodiles. It's the only place where you can find crocodiles in the United States. So those are the places you can see them. As far as finding out what to do to help them, you know, I'm not an advocate for any particular group, but I would say that the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has a very nice website that talks about manatees and about the research. They are the lead in doing scientific research on manatees, along with the U.S. Geological Survey. They have a Sirenian group based in Gainesville that actually maintains that SCAR catalog I mentioned. And they were the source for a lot of the historical documents I was able to use in my book. So those, between those two, they produce a tremendous amount of information. And my book is more focused on sort of the history of manatee protection and the history of the laws and storytelling, that kind of thing. If you're interested in the biology and the science and the natural history part of that, Bob Bondi and Roger Reap, two manatee biologists, have written a book called The Florida Manatee that's quite good if that's what your focus is.
Just to close, you had said in various other interviews that manatees tend to fascinate people, but what you've always found so fascinating is the effect manatees have on people.
Yes, I love to see how people react to them, because they really dazzle people. They're these kind of homely creatures, and yet people find them absolutely fascinating. And they have popped up in all sorts of unlikely places. I mean, you know, on the old Conan O'Brien show, he had a sort of a naughty manatee character. You see him in children's books and in children's TV shows. VeggieTales actually featured a song called Barbara Manatee. There's a mystery book called Naked Came the Manatee, another one called Hour of the Manatee. I mean, they're just so popular, and they pop up everywhere. And if you go to one of these places where the tourists flock to see manatees, like Crystal River, you will find representations of manatees just about everywhere you can think of. I mean, they're on the badges of the police force in Crystal River. They sell manatee hot sauce, and they're on part of the name of the muffler shop there and the beauty salon. I mean, you know, I don't think they make you look like a manatee. They're just a manatee beauty salon. You know, they're just trying to cash in on the idea that, you know, hey, people are there to see manatees because they're just such interesting creatures to look at. And they're one of the most popular exhibits at the Lowry Park Zoo here in Tampa. People, you know, kids flock there and put their noses up against the glass and see them swimming around in there, and they just hang there. They're fascinated at it because they look so unwieldy when you see them in the abstract, but when you see them in the water, they're incredibly graceful. Bob Bondi, the guy whose name I mentioned a little earlier, he and his wife Kathy Beck came here from California, where they worked on animal skeletons, whale skeletons, things like that, and they were hired to work in on manatees, and they were going out and picking up these dead manatee carcasses all over the state, and they thought manatees were really kind of stupid, that they were like cows that had wandered onto the highway and gotten hit. And then Buddy Powell, the teenager that had gotten interested in manatees when he was living in Crystal River, took them to Crystal River and said, you need to see them in their natural element. You need to see them swimming. And they got in the water with their snorkel gear and swam around the manatees and were just blown away at how graceful they are and how beautiful their movements are. And they just sort of fell in love with the subject, and they've been here for 30 years now, and they're still studying manatees. So, I mean, it's just that contrast between the expectation you have when you see them and then the way they behave in the water is quite fascinating. And actually, they're smarter than a lot of people think. Joe Moore, the guy who started in the 40s documenting the scars, he wrote a paper in which he described some of the tricks done by a couple of the manatees that were in captivity, and they're the same tricks that dolphins do. And he was arguing that they are at least as smart as dolphins because they can be trained to do tricks in return for reward. So they're not just some dumb animal, that they have some intelligence as well.
Oh, interesting. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on the show. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about manatees with St. Petersburg Times environmental reporter Craig Pittman, who's also author of Manatee Insanity, Inside the War Over Florida's Most Famous Endangered Species. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's MONGABAY.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.